Welcome back to season two of The Philanthropist's Conversation from Pegasus. On this show, we bring you stories of resilience to prepare for a better future. And this season, we're diving into the world of food. This episode, we're flying to Vietnam to explore the flavors of Southeast Asia. We remind ourselves of what life looks like when we're buying fresh ingredients for every meal and cooking three times a day. Along the way, we'll learn about the ancestral history of Asian cuisine. We'll explore the link between food and health and find out how social media can play a big role in food education. You're in for a world of discovery. Now, remember, this episode is an hour long, so when you hear this sound, feel free to pause, dive into the resources we've left in the show notes. There's always something waiting for you there. Or just continue enjoying the episode. All right, and with that, let's meet our gang in the streets of Hanoi.
Ooh, that fish smell in the air. I mean, we must be getting close, right?
Yep, we're just around the corner. Hope the scent doesn't put you off breakfast.
Honestly, with this jet lag, I feel like breakfast is dinner, so a fish soup doesn't feel that crazy.
Yeah, that's the Garth I know. Well, hope Choham Market won't disappoint.
No, trust me, it's a great spot, man.
Oh, and say hi to our listeners, by the way.
Wait a minute. You started recording?
Yep.
Hi, everyone. If you're wondering where we've landed and what the hell we're doing up at the crack of dawn, headed for a fish market, well, all I can say is, welcome to Hanoi.
That's right. We're now in Vietnam. It's 8 a.m. here and 9 p.m. back home, so definitely a shock for the system. But when we were building this series, we thought, what is the exact opposite of American food? What is not ultra-processed, ultra-ready, pick it up on the shelf, dump it in the microwave and go?
And can food be quick and fresh? Like, is that even possible? Well, I'd say in Vietnam, the answer is yes. Today, we're going to see a place where people pick up fresh ingredients every day. The culinary culture here is both simple and refined. We're talking humble ingredients, but really great flavors.
Hell yeah. Hanoi is going to help us remember what real cooking looks like day in, day out.
And why good food does not have to be expensive.
As per last time, we'll be joined by Mateo, Zane, and Rowan. In fact, we're meeting the gang at Hom Market just now.
Hom Market is a food market where locals come to shop every day. Here, you'll find everything from veggies and fruit to street food, and even fabric for garments.
It's a real treasure trove and a quintessential part of Hanoi's food scene.
And now, it's just around the corner. This is The Philanthropist's Conversation. Culture, resilience, and the food that sustains us.
Episode 2, Tipping the Balance Back in Hanoi, Vietnam. Okay, so where are we meeting the others?
Well, Rowan has gone off on his own to shop for meat, but Zane and Mateo are meant to join us for breakfast. So maybe we head through the market, try to find him.
Sure. Man, look at this abundance. So many fresh herbs and fruits. It's amazing.
Yeah, and it smells great, too. And nothing's even been cooked yet. It's like you can already taste everything.
Sign of quality, if you ask me.
Totally. Vietnam is known for this, you know.
You mean fragrant herbs?
Well, not just. The country stretches over 1,600 kilometers from north to south. It's got mountains and forests, deltas, and a really long coastline. So you've got an amazing diversity of ecosystems here, and a real variety of produce and regional specialties.
Wait, Garth, you should say for the people listening, you've been to Vietnam quite a few times, right?
Oh yeah, sure have. As part of my work at Pegasus, I've been doing work on food security initiatives, and there's a lot happening in South Asia. So yeah, I've been around, and every time I thought, man, this is a great case study to talk about food education and resilience, which is also why we came here this week.
Well, I hope you're not tired of Vietnam.
Not at all, buddy. In the north, where we are, you've got some iconic dishes, like pho.
Oh yeah, I love pho. That's the star of Vietnamese cuisine. Pho show.
I'm gonna pretend I didn't hear that. Also, not to be that guy, but it's pronounced pho.
Pho.
That's it. Anyways, so northern Vietnam is known for dishes that are delicate, like pho. And in central Vietnam, you'll find spicier dishes, lots of chili and lemongrass. And in the south, you've got tropical, sweeter recipes, often with a coconut base, for example. What's interesting as well is that herbs play a huge part in cooking here. They aren't just a garnish.
Yes, that's true. Although they are often added at the very end, right? You'll almost always see a side plate of herbs and greens on the side of your meal.
Correct. Vietnamese cooking keeps herbs raw and vibrant. You add them yourself, you just adjust to your taste.
Which is quite nice, actually. It means you can gently educate your taste buds.
Definitely. And it's very welcome when you're not a huge fan of chili pepper. You can turn the heat up gently.
Yeah, I'm going to need that, actually. What else did we need to say about Vietnamese cuisine? It's, I know, it's by essence quite healthy, too.
Definitely.
The local diet is known for being fresh, whole, low in sugar. It's balanced and good for you while still being super accessible. It goes to show simplicity doesn't mean plainness.
Mm-hmm. A typical Vietnamese dish tries to balance five key flavors: salty, sweet, sour, spicy, and bitter. It's really all about the balance. That's why every bite feels bright and fresh rather than heavy, even when you're eating noodles or grilled meat.
I think I can see Zane and Matt. See over there, right towards the back of the market, where you've got the street food vendors?
Oh, yeah, that's them. Well. Look who it is.
Oh, hey, guys.
What happened to you two? We thought you'd be way ahead of us.
Ah, well, you know, we were just wandering around, taking it all in.
Enjoying the experience, you know? Sue us.
Well, you're here now. So, shall we get some breakfast?
Absolutely. We're dying to eat.
Same. We walked past people who were wolfing down their food, and everything looked so good.
Guys, this stall looks busy. Should we stop here? They've got tables, too.
Oh, yeah, might be good for a proper rest stop.
Hey, I'll go grab your orders, guys. What do you want?
Seen lots of things. It's hard to say. Maybe walk us through some options?
Sure. Look, soup is kind of a classic here. You've got pho, which is typically a beef or even a chicken broth. Or if you'd rather something more seafood-based, I like to go for a bun ryu, which is closer to a crab and tomato ragu. Granted, other options might be like a bangoon, steamed rice rolls with pork and mushrooms, or a more simple but equally delicious option, like sticky rice on banana leaf. Comes with some brilliant toppings.
Ugh, this is hard. How about we do one of each? There's four of us, so that kind of works out.
Yeah, good idea.
Hey, Matt, that work for you too?
Sure, why not? I'm easy.
Cool. I've got this, guys. I'll be right back.
So who was it that recommended this spot, Rowan?
Nope, Garth, actually. I think this is one of his go-tos.
Doesn't feel like a tourist hotspot.
Right. My understanding is that it's mostly frequented by locals who come by for groceries before work. Just for the listeners, there are a ton of people here, and some of them are shopping, but others are just perched on plastic stools having breakfast.
Yeah, this is where everyone starts their day, really.
Shopping, first thing in the morning. Is that common practice?
I think so. In Vietnam, most meals are home-cooked, and if you buy food on the go, it's street food. It's fast, but freshly made, like what we are doing right now. So that does mean you go food shopping a lot more.
I see. In a way, cooking sets the pace, right? You start the day at the market, and then you return to cooking and eating again and again and again.
And places where you get food become social hubs. Look around us now. People are catching up. They've got their favorite vendors. There's probably plenty of gossip to go around as well.
Oh, I'm sure. But, I mean, culturally, markets are not just functional. It's also a space that was built for exchange. There's a clear link between how food is produced and how it's structuring our day, our family life, social relationships, the urban environment even. You're buying from someone who produces food or buys stock directly at the farm. You're in direct contact with the vendor. You establish a relationship. This kind of rapport gets lost in supermarket chains.
Agreed. Remember last time in New Orleans? Completely different experience. When do you ever see this kind of socializing in the supermarket aisle?
I mean, at your local grocer or bodega, I think it can exist. But in massive outlets, you're right, that does get lost. The other thing you get here is proximity. And things like personal recommendations. You know, you're encouraged to be curious and experiment with stuff you've never tried. just because it's in season and it's right there and the guy behind the stall knows the produce is really good. Learning to cook is a lot about that, too.
Yeah. It's a system of habits, really. It's a whole with many parts.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the eating is the best part, in my opinion.
Here we go.
Oh, that looks good. Yeah.
Smells good. Mm-hmm.
So I've got two soups, the rice, spring rolls.
Yeah, I'll have one.
Yeah, take care.
Thank you.
The Tupperwares are a bit hot, guys.
Yeah, thanks.
So I am discovering.
I guess they haven't escaped microplastics here.
For sure not. That's absolutely true. I mean, Asian restoration is the same all around the world, really. Sous vide machines and instant pots, kind of the standard.
So Asia doesn't completely escape globalization then?
Yeah, that's true. I suppose it's doing it differently, though. Asian cuisines are changing, but not in the ways you'd expect in the West. They're still holding on to traditions, but are reaching for a hyper-portable and modern way to eat. Oh my goodness, that is...
Oh, that smells lovely. Coriander and lemongrass?
That's right. And wait till you try this soup. Told you fish for breakfast wasn't scary.
No, honestly, it was delicious. And such a great introduction to what awaits us in Vietnam today.
True. Today, we're really diving back into a culture of everyday cooking.
We want to relearn what we've drifted from.
Coming up, we get back to the kitchen with our chef, Rowan. We're going full immersion mode, learning to cook the Vietnamese way. And we're cooking all together this time.
What's on the menu today, Garth?
Goi kun and bun cha, spring rolls and meatballs.
I've got a job for each of you, and I want some teamwork in this kitchen today.
Okay, oh boy.
We're going to make goi kun, the Vietnamese take on spring rolls. Goi kun literally means salad in rolls. It's a delicious little bite-sized snack with veg and meat or seafood wrapped in rice paper.
Oh, sounds very promising.
So, step one.
Oh, we put salad in rolls?
Yes, but not yet. First, we're going to set up the production line. It'll make things easier. My funny man Jay over here, you're going to be at the top, soaking the rice paper casings and setting them up. Zane, I want to see you filling up the veg. Mateo, you'll add the prawn. Then Gareth, you got a tricky job, but I believe in you.
Aw, what's it going to be this time?
You're going to be folding the rolls together, but don't worry. I'll show you the ropes. I'll take care of the pork, because I got the bun cha for us as well.
What is that?
Bun cha is like a caramelized pork meatball. It can be served in a broth over vermicelli noodles. It's pretty typical here in Hanoi.
That sounds very nice. Okay, everyone wash your hands, and then we can get started, shall we?
So, let me give you a sense of what's going on here. I'm soaking the rice paper in water, just a few seconds, to dampen the paper and loosen it. Here we go. And then I'm laying half a leaf of lettuce on top, lining them up nicely, just like that, and passing on to Zane. How's it going, man?
Pretty good.
What are you packing in?
I've got rice vermicelli noodles, which have been boiled already and coated with a little rice vinegar for taste. I've got fresh mint, Vietnamese basil, a couple of strands of soy for each roll. I'm trying to pack this up neatly, because Mateo's coming in with the prawns.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's nothing much to it, really. I just add prawns in a line. They're really small. Look.
You could fit at least three in there, then.
Yeah, I know, but I also don't want to overstuff.
And for that, I'm thankful, Mateo. Don't let Jay talk you into making my job harder.
What? I didn't do anything.
Oh, who's rolling all of this up, do you think?
All right, go ahead. Tell us how you're going to go about this.
Well, so I take the top edge of the rice paper, and I fold it over the veggies. Then I'm taking the sides in toward the center. It's sticky, so it's quite easy to bring the folds together. And from there, we roll.
That's looking good. Yeah, you've got some beautiful layers.
Thanks, man. With spring rolls, we're always tempted to go big on the filling. But if you want them to look good, you gotta rein it in a bit. Take your time.
Small quantities.
Less is more.
Exactly.
And it needs to be said, we are bashing these spring rolls out. It's going fast.
I mean, we kind of need to. I could eat three of these in 3 minutes.
I feel like this is probably how cultures hold on to food traditions, you know?
What? By snacking as you cook?
No, what I meant is you learn the recipe by making it a ritual, passing down skills, showing someone the ropes, getting everyone involved. It's fun.
Oh, for sure.
You know, Jake, the magic of it is also that this kind of stuff stays with you. Like when you smell or taste something and it reminds you of your childhood, memory is really tied to the senses. And so when you spend time in the kitchen, you actually keep the memory of food alive. My nan's kitchen was like that. She would sit you around the table and get you to work. And now every time I smell freshly steamed green beans, it comes back to me. So the experience of taste, flavors, the feel of food, it's a memory that gets ignited every time you're making food for yourself, you know?
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. I love that. What about you, Rowan? How's it going?
Just grilling.
Tell us more about bun cha then. Garth said they're like meatballs, essentially?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a dish that comes from north of Vietnam. You've got the juicy pork served with cold, slippery rice noodles and aromatic herbs for days.
That sounds both delicious and also kind of simple, if you don't mind me saying that.
No, totally. I mean, that's exactly it. Bun cha is a pick and mix kind of dish. You mix the different elements as you go. It's simple to assemble and it's also really good.
Nice. So you're not going to walk us through the whole recipe, but can you give us a couple of tips on how to make good bun cha? If you had to just recommend one thing.
Okay, so I'd say the pork. You really need to pick the right piece there. You want quite a fatty meat. That's because, look, as you grill, the fat melts and leaves you with this super moist and sweaty pork that's just so rich in taste. It's smoky, well-rounded, and like, it doesn't taste heavy, you know?
That makes me hungry. And so then you're gonna serve this with nyo kham sauce, correct?
Absolutely. Arguably the second most important thing here is the make or break moment for this dish.
I feel like most people have heard about nyo kham, but what's in the sauce?
It's a mix of fish sauce, rice vinegar, sugar, and lime juice. You can get it pre-mixed, but as you know, that's not my style. I'm going to whip up my own today.
And do you have a secret ingredient that makes yours special?
You think I'm going to say? Uh-uh. You'll have to take a guess at dinner, like everyone else.
Many secrets in this kitchen today.
Right?
But seriously, it's pretty cool to see tradition in practice. When you're together in the kitchen, you engage with local culture in a brand new way.
Agreed. Maybe that's the academic in me, but it's nearly like cooking is teaching us about Vietnam's culture and traditions, which we kind of need here because none of us really know what it's like to grow up and live in this part of the world.
Yeah, and just based on this morning, it's obvious that we are in a totally different world. I mean, this is not the food we know in the US or even Europe. Back home, going to the farmer's market is a treat, right? It's coded as a middle-class luxury. And in the same way, food is focused on portions. We need this many calories and proteins for a good meal. That's what we learn.
Mm-hmm, that's true. We're so focused on the end result that we lose our grip on how the thing comes to be.
Right. Here, cooking is not calculated. It's something that's ancestral and fundamental to how people connect with their environment and their body. There's a real history to this, which we're going to dive into now.
All right, that's the last of it. Well done, guys. We've basically got a mountain of those now.
Yeah, and yet somehow we've still eaten like a million of them while making them. I mean, what kind of sorcery is that?
That's the magic of small portions. Right, I'll help Rowan clean up. You guys take a break.
Oh, cheers.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
This place is nice, isn't it? Look at those shutters. It's one of these old French villas. Tall ceilings, soft yellow walls. Beautiful.
Yeah, it's like a piece of the past that hasn't quite decided if it belongs here or in Europe.
And that's Hanoi for you. Vietnamese soul and a French touch.
See anyone?
Always. You know, guys, I've been thinking about why Asian culture is more robust to UPFs. In places like Vietnam, South Korea, or Thailand, or even China, amid rapid urbanization and industrial development, the roots of local food culture are so deep. They still shape how people think about their health and their life. It's a culture tied to belief systems, a kind of personal philosophy, if you will. So it's harder for fast food chains like McDonald's to proliferate. When they plant themselves in the local environment, they don't fit in.
Well, sure. I mean, a Burger King or a McDonald's are not in the business of cultural integration anyways. They're really selling a product that is branded to be McDonald's or Burger King. You know, you're meant to be tempted by that.
It's a little presumptuous if you think about it.
But is it that surprising? The Western world is centered on its own identity. Historically, we've made a point of exporting it, and places like Vietnam are a reminder of that. I mean, we've got an example around us right now with all this Frenchness. Maybe that's why they're resisting the Western perspective now.
Maybe. I mean, the country's relationship with colonialism is layered. And there's the relationship with the US, too, which is difficult. The experience of modern chemical warfare, it is a sore wound, but I don't know. What if it's the other way around? Maybe Asia has historically been distant from the American and Western mindset because they have preserved their culture, the one that predates colonialization. Asian identities don't just exist as an act of resistance. It's centuries and centuries of tradition. In the West, we don't know these cultures intimately, so it's easy for us to glaze over that, right? The push towards industrialization comes from our side of the globe. Asian cultures have their own thing going on. And now we're at this point in time where we stand to learn from them, from their strength, their preserved heritage, their resilience.
Oh, well done. We love that word here.
Yeah, we do. But I do hear what you're saying. There's something here we need to dig into, I think. It's like, why are the roots of Asian food so strong? What is it in their food history that has helped them resist? The thing that struck me when I was here last is how food in Asia feels integrated into something much bigger. Like, food is health, is body, is environment. It's all one system. There isn't this separation we make in the West, where cuisine is over here, medicine is over there, and the natural world is a third category entirely. Instead, they have a way of thinking that's really holistic, if I can say that.
Interesting, yeah.
They're connecting the dots more.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by that too. Although, don't get me wrong, no country or region is perfect. Vietnam is a powerful example of a vibrant and ancestral food culture. However, it doesn't escape global pressures. You know, when I was saying Asian cultures are more resilient to UPFs, that doesn't mean these don't exist here. A recent study from Frontiers in Public Health found that changing lifestyles, increased urbanization, and exposure to global food marketing are changing people's habits in Vietnam. There is still a risk. But the point is, it's not done yet. And so we have an opportunity. We can still swoop in with a movement for food resilience that changes the message. It's high time to get the word out. Say that the tide is turning. Less, let's be like the West. More, let's learn from the East.
Matteo just said something crucial, I think. Even with the pull of Western brands or convenience culture, local habits anchor people. If we encourage that resilience, if we positively reinforce that culture, we can make it aspirational.
Mm-hmm. And we're at the turning point where you can really make it count, which, on that point, I think we need to talk about glocalization.
Do you want to define that term, Garth, for those of us who didn't study economic and social history in college?
Yes, of course, obviously. So, glocalization, It's the simultaneous process of globalization and localization, and it's not new. Some aspects of culture are becoming international phenomena, while others are reinforcing their cultural specificities. Asia has been doing this for a long time, blending external influences with deeply local practices.
And according to you, we're seeing this glocalization situation rear its head in food culture.
Mm-hmm. So to understand this better, maybe it's time we actually learn a bit about the history of food in Asia, don't you think? I mean, how these systems evolved, why they endure, and what they can teach us about eating.
Now, how convenient for our listeners. We actually did speak about this over lunch.
So, shall we sit down on the balcony, guys?
Ah, yeah. This could be our little tradition every episode. Lunch al fresco.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, if the weather allows. It's quite humid today, but I think we might avoid the rain. Plus, I'm all for the people watching. Look at that.
That woman on the bicycle?
She's got, what, 6 baskets balanced on the handlebars?
Yeah, that is wild.
Only in Hanoi.
Someone said baskets. I heed the call.
Dumpling baskets? Is that Vietnamese?
Well, let's bring roll baskets for now. Gong Khoi are ready.
Ooh.
Look at those. Oh my gosh.
Woo. Moment of truth. These spring rolls look too perfect. I almost don't want to eat mine.
Speak for yourself.
All right, then. Bon appetit, everyone. Or what do they say here?
They say, Xin Moi. That means please or after you. And actually, it's usually the youngest person around the table that goes out of their way to say it.
Oh, no. There you go.
Come on, Rowan. Have a little respect for your elders.
Xin Moi.
Xin Moi.
Xin Moi.
Xin Moi.
Okay, dig in.
That's so fresh. And I'm loving this shrimp.
Don't forget to dip it into the nook cham.
That sauce, very good. It's got the tang, the salt, and the sweetness, and there's something else.
Yeah, there's something kind of smoky.
Uh-huh.
But it's sweet, too. Is that roasted shallot?
Nope. Ah. So, full disclaimer, it's not traditional at all, but I've added a little bit of pineapple. I've charred it so it brings it this caramel note that I like.
Old move.
But it paid off.
I mean, this isn't pizza. There's a good foundation for balance. Sweet, sour, salty, spicy. We've got it all. Honestly, the ingredients did most of the work.
Hey, I didn't give my all on the production line to get denied the compliments I deserve.
Yeah.
Okay, but more seriously, Rowan, do you agree that, like, a healthy diet here in Vietnam is essentially fresh vegetables, fermented foods, low meat and fish, right?
Mm-hmm, that's right. To be fair, that kind of pattern applies to most Asian cuisines.
That's true.
The base of any Asian dish is often grains and a lot of veg, broths and soups, the occasional fish, and then sometimes a little meat.
That's interesting. I wonder why that is. I mean, do you think there are foodways that propagated in Asia that didn't quite reach Europe, for example?
Jay, I feel like you'd know this.
What was that? Sorry? I was absorbed in my food.
That's a good sign.
Zane was asking about the history of Asian food, how it's changed and evolved across the continent.
Sure. Well, I mean, if we go way back, I guess a good starting point is the Silk Road. When we think about Asian foods, we see what's on our plates today. Rich curries, delicate dumplings, tangy, spicy bowls of noodles. But to really understand how these flavors came together, we have to travel back, all the way back, to the paths of the Silk Road, the ancient trade route that linked China to the Mediterranean. From as early as 2000 BC, and more visibly by the first century, merchants and travelers carried goods on these roads. We remember silk and porcelain, or how horses and slaves were sold to do the labor. But food was at the heart of it too. Sacks of ginger root, bundles of garlic, cinnamon from Sri Lanka, turmeric from India, pepper from the tropical forests of the Malabar coast, spices are to the Silk Road like gems to a crown. In Rome and Alexandria, they were symbols of wealth, of power. goods that had traveled from Indonesia to Vietnam, through the Persian region, and into the Mediterranean. Ingredients and cooking techniques were exchanged. Then they were adapted to local palates until they became staples of national cuisine. In China, soy and ginger had been used for centuries, but garlic, herbs, and vegetables like cucumbers or carrots were introduced through northern roads. In South Asia, the maritime trade created new spice blends. Cumin and pepper and cinnamon were turned into curry sauces, and ginger and garlic, once medicinal, became everyday seasoning. What's fascinating is how all these threads, trade, identity, technique, and belief, intertwine. Food isn't just a reflection of geography or climate, it's a living record of human history, too.
Wow, what a trip.
Yeah, really was. It's fascinating. I have a question, though. Have these flavors changed much today? Is there a spice we associate with a place that really doesn't come from there?
Yeah, maybe chilies? Chilies are super common in Southeast Asia, but they were actually imported from the American continent.
And you know, guys, heat really plays a different role across the spectrum of Asian cooking. I mean, in China, it's a health thing. They've got this hot-cold philosophy.
That's actually how they build their recipes, right? Like, you need the balance of salt and sweet and acid and hot and cold.
Kinda. It's more like, if you're ill, your body is cold, so you need to tip the balance back by eating hot foods that warm you up. So maybe a broth, but also maybe something spicy, right?
Right. So say ginger would be hot while cucumber is cold because it's quite a refreshing water-based vegetable.
Correct. But what's actually important is hot and cold don't mean temperature. Every ingredient has what they call a nature. It's like an energetic quality. If your body is cold, maybe you're feeling sluggish and tired. You're meant to reach for warming or hot foods that will give you the fuel you need. But if you're too hot, that's, say, if you're stressed or maybe you've got inflammation, then cool or cold foods do the job. Things like watermelon or even raw herbs, like we've got right here. Then there's also neutral foods, staples like rice or simple grains. They don't push you either way. They're a grounding food.
Uh-huh. Which makes sense with what we were saying before, right? Grains are like the base of every dish.
Exactly. So, you see, with this vision, you're building a system that speaks to how the body feels, what it needs. You blend hot and cool, strong and gentle foods. You're trying to get a sense of balance. Suddenly, food is no longer just fuel. It's closer to holistic medicine in a way, which we know that herbs have that quality anyway.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty intuitive once you get into it. It's the same idea in India with Ayurveda. Your diet is meant to match your body type, your dosha, which is like three fundamental energies. So when you learn to cook properly, you're also learning how your body works. What slows you down, what gives you energy. The body kind of confirms the philosophy.
Exactly. And what I find fascinating is that in systems like traditional Chinese medicine, or Ayurveda, every ingredient has a place. It's like, imagine a periodic table, but for food. Every herb, every fish, every spice, it has its own space.
Yeah, it's like a cosmology of flavor.
Yes, Mateo, a cosmology, that's a perfect word. And because everything has a place, the goal isn't high protein or low carb, it's harmony. What feels and tastes good together. You layer foods based on how they interact with the body. You're composing.
Which is so different from the Western approach. I really see what you mean now. We break things down into categories, macros, vitamins, calories. We do calculations.
Exactly. And once you stop seeing food as math, Asian food culture starts making a lot more sense.
I mean, you know what's cool though? It really makes you see that the culinary world is a way of thinking. The way we eat is an actual philosophy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's other ways in which that pops up. Like with religion, for example, in India, the dominant religion is Hinduism, and it's shaped dietary habits for thousands of years. You've got something called ahimsa, non-violence towards all living beings. So no killing animals, which means a lot of vegetarian traditions. And that's just one example. You've also got karma. We all know what that means. And the Dharma, which essentially means duty. You've got these ethical and spiritual practices that guide your daily life. And so suddenly eating becomes connected with morality and faith, you know?
Yeah, the divine. Yeah. Sorry, butting in now, but I've always found that there is something profound and existential about eating. Food fuels us, it brings us to life, or rather, it keeps us alive. And so it's both instinctual and an act we sanctify every time we return to the table.
It's like a ritual.
Exactly. When you're sitting around the table, you're not just eating. You're socializing. You're breaking down how the day went, bonding with family sometimes. Well, sometimes arguing too. And so even if you're not religious, there's a spiritual quality to this act. It's like the dinner table is a place where belief systems are built.
And I see that. Jay, what do you make of all this?
That's all interesting. If I had to explain why food is existential like that, I think maybe it's because we need something to shape our behaviors. Think about it. The origins of many food practices have to do with food safety or hygiene. So surviving and avoiding diseases. That's been essential to our survival. And things like kosher or halal food, for example, they're methods for slaughter that require complete blood drainage from the animal killed. Now, in practice, that's great to keep meat fresh in environments without refrigeration. We also know that in Judaism, meat and dairy products cannot be cooked or eaten together, which means we have to use separate kitchen utensils and preparation areas. And that cuts down the risk of cross-contamination. So, I mean, belief systems have been useful in that way. They give us safeguards. And not that I want to set aside the religious significance, but I mean, you guys know what I mean, right? It's like there are real, tangible benefits to this storytelling.
No, we don't get it, Jay. How dare you be so insensitive?
No, don't cancel me.
I'm only joking. You know I agree.
Don't worry, Jay. The bottom line is health is a huge part of Asian food.
Hold that thought. I gotta get our next course.
Bun cha, baby.
Ta-da!
Now this is what I was waiting for.
Mmm. Oh, that smells delicious. Well, let's give it a try, shall we?
Yeah, that's unreal. You can actually taste the charcoal in the pork. It's like the meat got kissed by the fire. I don't know how you do that.
There's a real playfulness to it, isn't there? You've got the herbs, the mint, the basil, all cooling it down, and then that hit of garlic and chili just, oh, brings it right back up again.
And the sauce, it's light and rich. At the same time, talk about food for when you're ill. I feel like that's the stuff you want.
See, I feel like I relate to Chinese medicine, because when I'm ill, I have this weird craving for, like, kimchi. Is that weird? I always think it's like my gut is asking for fermented foods.
You find a lot of stuff in Asia too, actually. South Korea has kimchi, Japanese has miso, which is fermented bean paste made from like a specific mold particle.
Oh yeah?
Mm-mm. A lot of ferments come from mold, but I promise it's super, super healthy.
Actually, did you guys know that miso is used to treat the effects of exposure to radiation?
Oh wait, really?
Yeah. They found out that it's got these really great reparative qualities. They recommend it as a dietary staple for cancer patients who have had radiotherapy.
Yeah, I'd not heard about that. I did want to say, though, I think we need to be careful when we talk about food and how it can help our health. It would be really easy to fall in the trap of saying, food alone can cure you. But that's not really what it is. It's more a case of food is a factor of health. So when we pay attention to how we eat, we give ourselves a better chance to be healthy. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That's a good point.
It's just, this stuff really matters in my work. You can't treat a disease just by looking at food. Like, a diet won't be a replacement for medical care. But when you eat better, you have more energy, more vitamins, a better immune system, that kind of thing.
I totally see what you mean. And not that I want to continue banging on about Chinese medicine, but I do think it fits into what you're saying. They use the word medicine, but traditionally, this form of health practice is preventative, and it's about lifestyle first and foremost.
Yeah. I mean, even when we don't subscribe to it, I think we can believe and appreciate that food is a holistic art de vivre. That's what you're saying, Zane, right?
Yep. Essentially, learning to cook means learning to live well.
Well, All right, I think I'm officially ruined for Western barbecue after this.
Oh, good. That's kind of the point, you know? But Jay, what we're hearing here is quite interesting, right? Food and health are really connected. And if you look at cuisines across Asia, you can see that they're built within a lifestyle that cares about wellness and supports your health.
Sure. I'm quite intrigued by what Zane was saying there, though. The idea that what you eat should also sustain you, make you more robust. It makes sense. It's like the healthcare system is reactive. Everything else, food, exercise, is proactive. I mean, look, in countries like Japan or South Korea, where you have both extremely good food and great access to social services, including really good healthcare, people live for a very long time. You may not know this, but Japan has the highest number of supercentenarians in the world.
What?
Supercentenarians. People who live healthily beyond 100. If you Google it, you'll see. Japanese names abound.
And so, this is due to their lifestyle?
Yeah. And it's not just Japan. China and India also have plenty of people over 100. It's just that neither country tracked birth rates before the early 1900s, so the numbers are harder to confirm.
It tells you something about the world we live in, doesn't it? I mean, contemporary history, industrialization, globalization, all that, it's all moved incredibly fast. And yet, some of the healthiest and most resilient food traditions come from systems that are centuries old.
There's a real benefit to keeping the memory of food alive.
Keeps us alive, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, something we haven't talked about yet, but is exciting for us, is we're starting to get the benefit of this way of eating elsewhere in the world. I mean, we've been saying that we stand to learn from Vietnam and other Asian countries, but if we zoom back for a second, I think it's fair to say Asian food is kind of having a moment in the food scene. Korean, Vietnamese, Japanese, and even more regional, more authentic Chinese cuisines are super trendy right now.
Yeah, and it's been going on for a while. I'd say it's more than a trend. It's like we've gone through another loop in the globalization cycle. Except this time, we're not spreading techniques through trade or colonization. It's the internet doing its thing.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. You've got a very connected social media space that is breeding curiosity and moving recipes around the world. It started a new food education movement. We're actually going to get into that in a minute. But first, you know what I'm going to say now, right?
Back to the kitchen?
Off we go. Back at it already, Rowan?
Yep. Welcome to my life. I'm just doing prep for the phone now. That's the reality of cooking every day.
Far cry from the American way.
Yeah, I mean, from the global north more broadly. Ask a Brit how often they cook.
Hey, wait, don't say that. You've got a Brit right here. What am I doing?
Yeah, you're right. That's not fair. I guess we're not as bad as people tend to think, but we're not very good at teaching each other, are we?
Yeah, no, that's true. The average lunch growing up was not as delicious as hot noodle soup. Let's just put it that way.
Not that I don't like a ham and cheese sandwich, but...
Yeah, it's funny. My family was making some really good stuff at home, so I usually had leftovers the next day, and my lunchboxes were nice. But, like, you know, I always wanted my mate's food for lunch. Even if it was objectively worse.
I mean, that's just being a kid, right? You want to belong.
Plus, it's hard to resist the appeal of a salt and vinegar crisp.
Totally. And obviously, a lot of young kids don't grow up rolling spring rolls or braising a roast.
Yep. There's a real decline in hands-on food literacy at home and in British schools. I imagine it's the same in the US?
Oh, yeah. Which is a shame, because it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, look, it's not that we don't have access to good ingredients or tools outside of Asia. We do. But the scale of change we need won't happen overnight. We need to call on our local governments, school boards, and community groups to invest in this properly.
And in the meantime, the responsibility falls on us, which is also tricky. There's a researcher called Laura Smith. She works for the Chef Anne Foundation. And she talks about school kitchens as sites of transformation. If you teach kids about food early, and not just recipes, but decision-making, creativity, confidence, those skills then stick for life.
Yeah, I really see that too. Back in London, I've actually been doing community stuff. There's this cooking school for kids with ADHD, and I've been running classes for this group in the summer, and it's really cool to see them hopping around the kitchen, making a mess, getting playful with it, you know? These kids are full of energy, and cooking helps them focus and channel that buzz into something creative. The more time they spend in the kitchen, the more they come into their own, you know? They get to work as a team as well. There's real social benefit.
Yeah, it's a virtuous loop, right? You take joy in the process, you learn to like healthier foods, and you get to spend time with people your age, so you feel more connected with others. There's a ripple effect.
100%.
Imagine if we did this in every sphere of society. Like, cooking feels hard because we've got so much to do every day, but what if we had a community canteen down the block? Somewhere where we could volunteer and go there and get freshly made food at the end of a long day. You know, if you've got nothing in the fridge and cooking just feels like another task on the list, that could be a huge quality of life improvement. It would be a win-win for everyone. I wish we could reimagine the social structure around food like that.
And I think in London, you're starting to see initiatives like that. Some companies in the UK have volunteer schemes where employees can take a day out once a month to do work for charities. It's not a full part of your weekly routine, but it's a step forward.
Yeah, one of my mates actually spends his voluntary day out in soup kitchens in South London every month.
I forget what my sister does as part of hers. But yeah, these spaces are mostly created for individuals who struggle to access food. But it could well become the norm. We're not far from it.
That's really cool. In the US, I think we're still a little ways away, to be honest. I mean, we obviously have an issue with obesity, and because of that, we've seen things like culinary medicine programs pop up, but they are not free to access.
Really? They're not a charity incentive?
Well, actually, they tend to be run by community centers or educational institutions. So that is funded on their dime. But then you have to convince people to show up and contribute financially. Although some universities are trying to do things differently. Have you heard of the Teaching Kitchen?
No, what is that?
It's a kind of community kitchen that's run at Yale. It was launched by Dr. Nathan Wood. The way it works is any patient who has a Yale doctor can be referred and then join classes at the Teaching Kitchen completely for free. Yale's program is run by the hospital, so it's a part of the medical system, and people are referred directly through their doctors. Patients actually see it as like a care plan. The best part is that no insurance is required, no billing, no co-pays. The hospital absorbs the cost to remove the barrier.
Fascinating. And you see how, again, here, food and health are so intertwined.
Oh, yeah. The Teaching Kitchen is a fun cooking class, but it's also here to help people get healthy.
It seems like people change their habits through three mechanisms: culture, exposure, and support. So when we're introduced to new foods in our environment, when we're shown new cooking techniques and how to sustain healthier routines, we're better positioned to adapt. In some ways, it doesn't matter where that comes from, as long as it's available and easy to access.
Agreed. The idea that people are too set in their ways just isn't true. When change is framed positively, and, you know, when it tastes good, people respond.
Speaking of things that taste good, I've got a pretty tasty broth right here.
Wait, so are we meant to pick up a bowl and eat now? I am still full from lunch.
Nah. This still needs to sit for a few.
Woo, man. Whew, that is fragrant. I'm getting star anise straight away and something a little smoky.
Yeah, that's the charred onion and ginger. You torch them on a stick under the grill until they're almost black. It gives the broth that deep, slightly sweet backbone.
And it's also got some spice.
Yeah, that's right. Cinnamon, cloves, coriander seed, fish sauce, but nothing heavy-handed. Pho is all about the balance.
Lovely. And what's giving it that roundness? Is it the bones?
Yeah, pho uses chunks or ribs. I've got beef here, but you can use chicken too if you prefer. You blanch the bones first, a quick boil, and dump the water on the broth so it stays clean. Then you let it go on a low and slow, and the marrow of the bone seeps right into the broth.
I mean, that already smells finished to me.
Trust me, it's not. This is the halfway point. The broth needs hours to come into its own. We've got a while to go.
Maybe time for a break then?
Yeah, I think Zane and Garth have nipped out to the front garden for coffee, if you want to join them.
Oh, hey guys.
Hey, where's Garth?
In the lodge here. He set up a coffee station.
Yo, what? Look at you.
I know, right? Baby Chef has flown out of the nest.
Ugh, I have to say this for myself. Wait, are you whisking a yolk? What kind of fancy coffee are you making?
Well, Vietnamese coffee. What else?
All right.
I learned to make this during the pandemic. Remember when everyone got into Asian coffee all of a sudden?
Yeah, big trend.
All right, so show us the ropes then.
Well, it's pretty simple to be honest. If a cappuccino and a custard had a baby, it would be a Vietnamese egg coffee. You make a super strong coffee, and then you whip up this silky sweet egg foam to have on top.
That sounds illegal in at least two countries.
And it tastes so good, it probably should be.
So go on then, show us how you do.
Yes, Chef. So you take one egg yolk, a spoon of sweetened condensed milk, and just the tiniest splash of vanilla. Then, whisk it. I'm aiming for this glossy, ribbony texture.
Yeah, look at that. That's a sheen. You're basically ready for French pastry school, mate.
No thanks. I'm a proud alum of the YouTube Academy of Pandemic Cooking.
That serves you right. Okay, and so the coffee part?
Right. Traditionally, you'd use a fin filter, the little metal drip thing. But I'm not a purist, so I've just made a very short espresso. Point is, it needs to be strong. Coffee first, then gently spoon the foam on top.
Although, pro tip, let it sit for a sec and layers will settle. Then when you sip, you get the warm, strong coffee through the foam.
Very good. I gotta say, I'm impressed. I didn't know you had it in you.
Why, thank you. Will everyone have one? I made a couple, but there's enough here for more.
Yes, please.
Jay, you go. I'll stay behind and help out.
All right.
Wow. That is decadent.
Right? And it's not a bad drink. I feel like we've seen these on Instagram everywhere. But it's nice to actually try them in real life.
It's like TikTok is luring you, but then you have to go and venture in for yourself.
Exactly. Tell you what, though, I do think the social media attention makes a difference.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I gotta say, I am a huge aficionado of YouTube cooking channels.
Oh, yeah? What do you watch?
During the pandemic, I was hooked on the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen. Remember that? Or, like, New York Times Cooking. They were my daily companions. They're really good for when you want to host a dinner party and not lose your mind. They come out with 45-minute videos where one chef makes a full Thanksgiving dinner. I love that kind of stuff. They lay it all out step by step, and I'm like, maybe I can make a turkey dinner this year. But you know what I mean, right? They make cooking real and tangible, and the editing is funny. It's cool. The whole thing is aspirational.
For sure. And the food you see on YouTube is super varied. There's something for the fitness buffs. You've got, as you said, the dinner party crowd. But also there's entire channels dedicated to specific cuisines. Like Asian fusion is huge, actually. It's helped by the fact that global trade has now brought Asian ingredients to your doorstep, which I guess that's a little disputable. Yeah, it's always better to cook with locally sourced ingredients, but I do appreciate that we're all learning to make ramen the traditional way, you know?
Yeah, I see what you mean. It's like that content opens a window to make you understand where dishes come from, how to put your own spin on them, all that good stuff.
All that good stuff. I was going to say something else as well. What was it? Oh, yeah. Jay, you were saying that during the pandemic, you were watching more of this. I really think COVID-19 changed our relationship to food and health, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We rediscovered cooking at home, I think. We were all making sourdough bread all of a sudden, remember? And kimchi and mustard and stuff.
Had a bit of a pickle phase, Jay?
A huge pickle phase.
That's funny.
But it wasn't just food, though. We became aware of our need for physical activity, I think. You would not believe the number of people who signed up for remote personal training and nutrition plans during that period.
I am not surprised. You had the perfect storm of spending more time at home with nowhere else to go, and also a news context that, for very serious reasons, made us pay attention to our bodies.
Yeah. Plus, you know, when you're stressed or bored, you might experience more cravings. The primitive parts of our brain that value sugar, salt, and fat are activated by what feels out of our control. So when the whole world is on high alert and everything shuts down, suddenly your daily routine is upside down, you find yourself at home snacking all day. And so, naturally, you start thinking, how can I regulate my appetite to not fall into this passive eating thing? Like, if this crisis is going to last a few months, how do I change my lifestyle and adopt to this new normal? Remember how we used to say that all the time? The new normal?
Ugh, I still have PTSD. The craving thing is interesting, though. It ties back to what we were saying last time about UPFs. Processed foods are concentrated with flavor, and our brains are almost tricked into thinking we're nourishing ourselves correctly. Whereas, actually, we don't need high amounts of fat. We're mostly sedentary. That felt even more real during COVID.
That's what I mean. I think it finally lifted the veil. People had a real wake-up call.
Yeah.
During the pandemic, we were brought face-to-face with those instincts. We had to tackle them head-on.
Here we are.
That's for you, Jay.
And thank you.
What have we missed?
We were talking about the pandemic and how it kind of rewired our relationship to food and health.
Yeah, we were saying many people got more active during that period. It was like a culinary revival, in a way.
Oh, yeah.
What's your take, Garth, from the industry perspective?
I mean, it's an interesting one. With the pandemic, global trade slowed down, and that meant a lot of places, be that restaurants or supermarkets, had to look for alternative suppliers. It encouraged local activity, which is great, but it also showed us the limitations of our system and where we really overconsume, you know? Like, remember how essentials like bread or toilet paper were hard to find because people would buy them all up? We were really forced to reconsider our consumption.
Yeah, and that aspect was pretty hard for restaurants as well. The last thing people wanted to do during the pandemic is pay for highly priced meals. But on the upside, the cool thing is that there was a lot of solidarity and cared for restaurant owners during that time. People felt called to contribute.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. It was a real collective reset. We were called back to something essential about food. How it gets to our plate. Who provides it? Who makes it for us? What happens when we can no longer access that? And I think that changed people. We really became conscious of how fragile the system can be. And honestly, it was pretty empowering to take even a tiny part of it back into our own hands.
Maybe the overarching thought is that resilience in that context meant paying attention to the institutions that feed us, to the gaps in what's available, and to our bodies as well. Feeding ourselves better means being real with ourselves about what we want, what we don't want, where we're just craving something versus where we actually need care. And maybe it's making sure we're eating well and eating enough when we really mean it.
Jay, that was inspirational.
Well, what can I say? It just comes to me.
A poet. But seriously, I think the convenience actually makes us forget things.
Yes.
The way things used to be. I mean, we've seen this here. In Vietnam and in Asia more broadly, the food history is everywhere. On social media, sure, but also down at the market, in the kitchen, tucked inside a bowl of broth passed down generations. When you get down to it, how will we do that in the West? Do we need a shock to the system?
I mean, yeah, maybe. Or it's about reconnecting with how food actually makes us feel and looking for that harmony. When we start doing that, there's real flavor that we can discover again and again in every meal.
Rowan, this pho is just great.
So full.
And so different from the one we had this morning, though, right?
I mean, yeah.
Every bowl is different, Mateo. That's the thing.
All right, final round, people. We've just finished dinner, and I think we've eaten half of Hanoi at this point. What are we taking home from all this?
Well, I'll go first. I think if this trip proved anything, it's that balance is the missing ingredient in Western food culture. The food we've had today has been so harmonious. It tasted great, it made us feel good in our bodies, and it's been made with love by every single one of us, So maybe we let go of our obsession for categories, you know, carbs, protein, fiber, and drawing lines in the sand. The flavors we're addicted to, they're confusing our taste buds, but the body knows what's real, what's nourishing. Let's reconnect with that.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, Garth. It's like we need to get back this sense of composition. A fresh bowl of noodles also comes with fresh herbs, vegetables, lean meats, and fish. It makes you feel different than a fast food meal, even if both are fast eats. If we can bring this sense of harmony into Western culture, we can reform the system.
And Jay, you know what we were saying about COVID? How it rewired our lifestyles, perhaps for the better? It's kind of like that, I guess. When we understand what balance really feels like, it changes our relationship with food and health every day.
Yeah, food culture is a living teacher.
Exactly. So, like, I think what I'll add here is traditional diets, like those found in Vietnam, offer more than just nutrient balance. They're systems of longevity that are actually quite simple. We need to hack into that. Asian cultures seem to have been built on an alignment between food that gives us energy, the body we live in, and the environment we inhabit. When you cook, you keep the memory of food alive. When you shop and eat, you get social connections. You build community. When you're active rather than passive about your eating, you end up living better and longer. It all comes together.
Yeah, this is the thing. Mindful eating isn't about perfection. It's about attention. In a world engineered for passive consumption, choosing to slow down, to savor, to share, and think about what we eat is a quiet act of empowerment. That's something that really stayed with me today, because it's one of the most accessible forms of food resilience available to anyone, anywhere. And honestly, in a world created for distraction, that's huge.
Yeah, attention is the great equalizer. All right, Rowan, take us home. What's your take?
Oh, man, it's hard. All of you are really good with this stuff. You're pulling out all the stops. I guess what I think about is the real sense of identity that you can derive from every single dish. And as you said, Jay, Mateo, obviously it's a cultural thing that has to be passed on. But I think it's also because when you're cooking every day, it's like affirming. You're really autonomous. Even a basic meal, it gives you agency and control. It strengthens your connection with others, but also yourself. And it's because you know yourself better that you can take care of yourself. So if you learn to cook, especially as a young person, it improves your life. And once you're hooked on that, it's really hard to go back to that ultra processed stuff. Like, none of us want to feel worse. So actually, like, maybe learning to cook is the most direct way to transform the food system.
What a way to finish. I mean, can you believe he was intimidated to say his part?
Chills. I've got chills. Feel my arm. Step aside, Mateo. We got a new philosopher in the house.
Rowan, man, never doubt yourself, buddy.
Anyway, that concludes our time in Vietnam, folks. What's next on the travel plan, Garth?
Drum roll, please. Next time, we will be in Istanbul. Time to head back west.
Or, like, to the place where East meets West, geographically and spiritually. We want to bring back what we've learned from Asia and really take the next step.
Reconcile harmony with modernity. And the Mediterranean is a really interesting place for that. Quite a mix of influences there.
Yeah, a real mezze.
Oh, I can't believe I didn't see that one coming.
I had to. It was too easy. And it's the end of the episode. We're basically wrapping up. I have been so good the entire time.
Dear listeners, we know you've heard enough. So we'll see you next time.
In Turkey. For another episode of The Philanthropist's Conversation.
You've been listening to Season 2 of The Philanthropist's Conversation, a podcast by Pegasus. Content direction by Ivan C. Research and pre-production by Ryan Sutton, Daria Lawson, and Liz Lovatti. Writing and production from Liz Lovatti with the help of Sam Dettabollen. The sound design this episode was from Ben Cranell. Voice acting, David Ault, Sean Finity, Nick Gill, Rob Leland, and Amir Salim. The Philanthropist's Conversation is a fictional piece based on real interviews with researchers, policymakers, and experts in the field of resilience. continue learning, head to the show notes to find the resources used in the making of this episode. We want to thank Thomas Gramillion, Laura Smith, Lindsay Smith-Taylor, Nate Wood, and Walter Willett for their valued contributions. Their research is the foundation of this season.